Hello, welcome to Rethink, a podcast focused on the future of skilled nursing. I'm Sahida Siddiqui, editor at Skilled Nursing News. I'm joined today by Efraim Weinfeld, founder and CEO of Aliyah Healthcare, an Illinois-based skilled nursing and post-acute care provider. Efraim founded Aliyah just over 3 years ago and recently transitioned into the CEO role after restructuring the organization's leadership to focus more on long-term strategy and growth. Under his leadership, Aliyah has evolved from rapidly acquiring and revitalizing distressed facilities to strengthening its operational foundation, achieving company-wide improvements in quality metrics, 5-star ratings, and one of its lowest 30-day hospital readmission rates to date. Today, we'll discuss that evolution, the lessons learned from rapid growth, and what comes next for Aliyah Healthcare. But before we dive into that conversation, I'd like to highlight the Rethink Conference. Skilled Nursing News and our sister publication, Senior Housing News, are proud to present Rethink, the premier conference for leaders shaping the future of skilled nursing, long-term care, and assisted living. Taking place September 28th through 30th, 2026 in Philadelphia, Rethink is designed as an intimate, high-trust gathering of owners, operational leaders, clinical executives, investors, finance professionals, technology innovators, consultants, and strategic partners. The program, curated by the Skilled Nursing News and Senior Housing News editorial teams, will feature executive-led panels, fireside conversations, and peer-driven discussions. Sessions will explore the most consequential issues facing the sector, from clinical quality, staffing, and hospital partnerships to investment strategy, portfolio growth, technology, and the policy environment. Visit snnrethinkconference.com to learn more. And now, my conversation with Efraim Weinfeld. So let's start with the general outlook for Aliyah. Can you maybe reflect on Aliyah's last few months and describe one win that the company achieved in the last year?
Sure. So I'll give you context ahead of time. I think leading up to this, a lot of our mentality was in growing in order to build a foundation, which might sound backwards, but what we know and what we've seen is the amount of different operations and companies. There's so many, right? There's so many different like organizations out there, and what sets them apart? What's different? Why do some people succeed? Why do some fail? And as we grew, given that we weren't doing ground up organizations, we were taking over distressed facilities that people gave up on effectively. And coming in, and we learned a lot through that. And we spent the first couple of years with growing, learning, and seeing, and being exposed to both the good and the bad, you know, from other organizations that we absorbed. And the last 6 months, 9 months, we focused really on not growing, but on taking a step back, being introspective about what was working, what wasn't working, and learning from that and putting those things in place. There were problems that we had over the years, for sure within the first year, when it came to regulatory compliance and survey management. Within our business development department, we did a lot of just grow, hustle, you know, but a lot of, what do they call it, paper tiger? You know, house of cards, if you will, to some extent, where, you know, it's fine. It works for some time when you're running on pure adrenaline and hustle. But, you know, we spent a lot of time over the last few months with identifying the gaps that we had, seeing what worked on its own and learning from those mistakes and putting the right people in place. So when we brought on a chief clinical officer a few months ago that has been absolutely phenomenal as far as guiding the direction of the organization. We made some changes with our leadership structure, again, by example of you know, me shifting my role as well, and Crystal Shelby, you know, being promoted to the COO. and a lot of call it reorg that has benefited us greatly. I mean, I've seen the results in our return to hospital. So if you want to ask just proud accomplishments, our return to hospital is the lowest it's been as a company for the last 3 months that it's been ever. Averaging at about 17% company-wide for a 30-day, which might not sound like the pretty numbers that people like to sell out there. But I mean, if you look at the actual national averages or even state averages on Medicare.gov, you're looking at like 24-25% as an average. So very proud of that. Our quality measure is all kicking in. We have, believe now, 90% of our buildings are 5 stars with our QMs, long stays, and overall, which is amazing. So really, really proud of that. Proud of some of the discipline involved in that decision making as well, because it is fun to grow. Yeah, it's fun. It's fun to build, but you know, the discipline of taking a step back and enhancing what we have has been very rewarding.
Mm-hmm. When you started 3 years ago, could you give me the background on whether these were buildings that were existing buildings, or you built them from the ground up, or how?
These were all existing. Yeah, and it started with when ManorCare ProMedica was divesting all of their facilities. There were 2 facilities that were left in Illinois that were unaccounted for, mm-hmm. and no one really wanted them. And I was open to the challenge and the opportunity there. I was at that point was leaving my family that I'd worked for about 10 years. And started with those 2. And then a few months later, another organization was divesting out of Illinois as well, Symphony Healthcare. Again, these were challenged homes. A lot of them were challenged homes. And again, you know, it's how we got into those. Following that was Aperion facilities, which Aperion still exists, I mean, in Illinois, but there were homes that were not working well for them, we'll say, and wasn't working out that we came into. Then we took over another 2 homes that were from Extended Care, also an Illinois organization, which again still exists, but these are homes that, you know, they weren't being successful. So really all of them were effectively, like I said earlier, kind of the ones that were left behind. You know, these weren't like, oh, these are performing really well, let's sell them at top dollar. These were losing a ton of money. We've got survey issues up to Wazoo, and we've been trying to figure it out for years, and we can't. So, you know, if someone else can, great. And there have been challenges, you know, and that comes with challenges, but very proud of what we've built and how much we've been able to improve them and invest in them, both in physical CapEx and aesthetics, but also the team and the people and the quality that we get to provide.
Great. That's fantastic. So, and it seems like during this time you've substantially grown your footprint, right? And bringing these in addition to improving these struggling facilities, you've consistently gone on to expand your footprint. And so, this is going to be a question a little bit later in terms of what investments you have in the future. But just sticking with your outlook for now, wanted to ask you. What would you describe as like the one big challenge that Aaliyah has faced over the course of 2025 and into 2026?
It's an interesting question. If I'm going to point to the one, I mean, I try not to finger point, you know, I'd like to look at every problem or every challenge as an opportunity for something that we can do better and that we can learn from and not really take a victim complex. That being said, the lack of collaboration on the regulatory environment and the quality environment, you know, with the Department of Public Health, specifically within Illinois, has been a challenge, an understandable challenge given from the history of called greed, you know, or neglect that has occurred within the industry, and to pretend like that hasn't, or that everything was always hunky dory here, and why are we being, you know, treated the way we're treated? I understand that, but I do find that to be a challenge. Where I would like to be able to just have open conversations and dialogue about what is it that you're seeing that we can be improving on? You know, what is working, what isn't working, and having a little bit of a grace to be able to build on what is working and to fix what's not working, rather than be punished for transparency when our goal is to be real and to work together for the sake of our patients. So I think the lack of grace and collaboration was a bit of a challenge, an understandable challenge, but one that, again, my answer always is, let's just be better then, right? I mean, if we're not going to get something that might be helpful, that's fine. What can we do to control? Because that's all that you can really do. So that kind of getting kicked in the pants every once in a while is more demotivating than not. So being able to rally around that and believe, okay, but we are better than, you know, we are better than the star rating that we walked into, right? We are better than the survey maybe that we just experienced. We are better than maybe the perception could have been from others, because we know what we're doing internally. We know what our metrics are. We know that we care, and we know that we're willing to put our money where our mouth is to continue improving that.
Right. And what are your priorities, top priorities and goals as CEO this year?
One is to, of course, continue enhance, you know, an environment where independence is both empowered and rewarded, where people can make those decisions as much as they can on their own and have the resources available to them, but build that environment, continue building that environment in which our leaders and our facilities and our regional team have a true sense of ownership and responsibility that they can kind of create and taste their own success. So that would be number one. Number two is to work on more innovative approaches, you know, take a few more chances. You know, we put a big focus on kind of back to basics, which is one of those cliche terms that you'll hear over and over again, for good reason. You know, nothing ever beats showing up. Nothing's ever going to beat the DON that's taking call to try to avoid return to hospital. You could have a great software and a great like product and shtick, but nothing's ever going to be like what are your day to day look like? What is your guardian angel rounds in the morning look like? Basic survey prep, what that looks like. So, you know, that is a big focus that we have coming in as far as stabilizing, but I would like to take some swings with robotics and some more technological components. I'm doing a little bit more sexy stuff as well with the facilities when it comes to like remodels and, more unique programming. So that's certainly on the docket. And then as an organization, I mean, my goal is to grow our company continuously. So that means both going to other states and other regions. You know, we focused on the backyard, you know, where we knew or we had a little more knowledge base in Illinois, and kind of build something from there as a strong foundation to then be able to apply what we've learned and our styles and approach to other cultures and to other regions with different payer models and learn how to grow within that, while at the same time growing out also the model that we started now, where we help new operators get started, you know, within the company, creating really sister organizations that are still under the ALIA umbrella, where we have independent owners that have equity coming in the door that are able to truly take ownership of their region and give them the focus and the time and attention that needs, whether that's in Chicagoland, which now we started that with two particular operators spanning about 800 beds between those two, maybe a little more, about 900, maybe. Actually, almost 1,000 beds now I'm thinking about it. And, you know, looking to do a similar concept as well in other states to be able to give them the resources that they need while allowing them to really run it as their own.
All right. That's a perfect segue, actually, into my next question on investments. And so tell us about how you are reinvesting in your core footprint. And then you mentioned plans to expand beyond this core footprint in Illinois. Tell us about that as well.
So as far as just reinvesting in the core footprint, I mean, always going to be my baby, right? What we started with for the first 2 years that we built. I mean, it's always going to be like the emotional anchor, and also really where, you know, we learn and are able to share with others as we keep growing. So there is going to be capital investment for sure. Right? That we've already started a lot of, been like as simple as replacing all of the nurses' stations. Like we've got like these, they're beautiful. I love it. It's like, it feels like you're like in a hotel, you know, which is important to have more of that built in there. You know, we took over buildings in difficult positions and we did a lot of the not sexy investments, whether that's like the HVAC units and water heaters and just basic, the roofs, like we're talking millions and millions of dollars that like don't really feel good. You know, they're not like, oh, look, love to come here. They got a brand new roof. Like that doesn't really sell. But I had to prioritize what I knew would be easy to kick down the road. And that I think a lot of the buildings that we did take over, the can was kicked down the road. And we don't like that, right? We'd rather spend the money on the things that are needed immediately rather than the stuff that maybe sells better to the world. That being said, you know, now we're spending a lot more time with kind of the aesthetics and continue to rehab. We've got an open house actually tonight that I'm going to for one of our facilities where we invested over $1 million into. And not like even census was bad there, but it's just philosophically, we're continuing to reinvest. We have never even distributed. I've never taken money out of our business from our buildings. We reinvest all of it back in there, whether that's with, again, those capital expenditures that we're continuing to enhance those, whether that's with more staff for the building, more support staff for the building. We've added, you know, whether it's consultants or different programs, we continue to do that. So as far as the core footprint, the reinvestment is going to be both with just beautifying what we have and kind of what we know the guts look like. We want to share that externally as well because it's a point of pride, I think, for both for our families, our residents, you know, for our staff that come into work and feel great about where they're walking into. Outside of just feeling great internally, being able to have that external beauty as well. We're continuing to build out potentially actually more beds in a few facilities where we thankfully had, you know, occupancy challenges because they're too full. So we are looking at a few facilities where we're looking to actually add more beds to within. And that's the primary gist, like I said earlier, as far as like robotics and trying to do some more technologically forward decision making. That's where we're at there. So that's as far as core goes. As far as expanding, we have a level of a rule, you know, if you will, and some discipline involved in how we've grown up until now that we would continue, which is even in going out of state and going to Embow State, I mean, whether that's Midwest region, which is ideal, you know, to have somewhere a little bit closer, but if not, even in other states where we focus on more city, some more urban areas and clusters. So I think there's, while I could have taken deals where it's like 100 beds here and 300 beds here, and oh, you can have 7 buildings in this state. Yeah, great, but they're all, you know, hours apart, and like it matters to me that you have that feeling of a team that can collaborate together, that can meet up together, that speaks the same language, that can really build off of each other for both a feeling and a personal component. But there's also from just a business side of things, it scales better when you can share resources. And from a business development perspective, you can help our hospital partners a lot better when, okay, we have a building here that specializes in this, a building right here that specializes in that, a building that specializes in that. And you have access to all of those versus spreading out everywhere. And then you're trying to do a little bit of everything in each region. Let's focus on one region where we can specialize in different areas within that region to be able to serve those communities better.
Mm-hmm. Just a related question here to finding deals within skilled nursing. We're hearing a lot that they've been few and far between. Has that been your experience this year?
That's interesting. I'm a religious person, so I tend to view all this really through the lens of God and when a building, you know, when an opportunity is supposed to happen, it presents itself. I don't think there's ever been a time in the market, if you ever look at, like, whether on Skilled Nursing News, right, you're going through the article. I mean, I love reading the articles, and there's always, you know, you see transactions happening, big, small, here, there. Yet there's always going to be an article that says, it's really hard right now. You know, it's the toughest regulatory environment ever. It's the toughest transaction environment ever. It's the toughest. It's always hard. You know, it's always hard in any state. It's always hard in any region. It's always hard. And this is not a unique thing, I think, to our industry specifically in healthcare and SNFs. I think, like, you can say the same thing in real estate or you know, in any other, in financial markets. Like, there's, it's just how well are you doing it and being in the right place at the right time and knowing the right people and being willing to see something through and being able to potentially make compromises, you know, when it comes to and creative, I guess, in how you get the transaction done. So there's been plenty of deals that come around. It's just, okay, I've decided I don't want to compromise in certain areas. So therefore, okay, that hurts me sometimes. But I know that when the right thing comes along and it makes the most sense, then we're going to do it. But I will also say, just being raw and honest over here, it was a lot easier when I first started, you know, and you have nothing to lose to some extent, you know, you're kind of like back against the wall. Like, you have a little bit of that, like, startup, like, what do you, you know, take whatever. When you've built something, you're now at a risk of hurting other parts of your organization by stretching yourself too thin. So I've always been very mindful of that, which is kind of why I started shifting this model where I have kind of sister companies, sub operators, because I realized your attention can only span so far. And people do it. People grow to like 40, 50, 60 and tons of beds and all of that, but then they're not paying attention. You can't have an owner mentality for 60 buildings. It's impossible. You could say you are, but you're not. So people get a little bit greedy, but then eventually it ends up showing cracks. And then, you know, I end up acquiring those buildings because they're distressed. You know, so would you rather be on the reaction front or be less greedy on the front end, let someone else share in that success and, know that they're going to do a better job and a sustainably better job. So that's kind of how I view that. There's definitely opportunity there if you want it. But it depends on what your filters are for what you're looking for. And ultimately, when God decides that the time's going to be for something to happen, that's when it's going to happen.
Is there like a mental cap at the number of facilities you want to acquire this year? Or, I mean, like, also not just logistically, but financially, do you have any sorts of, limits?
Any cap. So, let's see this. The short answer is no. The answer to why it's a no is we're not going to make a decision that's irresponsible, that's going to potentially hurt lives. You know, this isn't just a financial question. These are people's lives that we have a responsibility to care for. And I know I've seen like a lot of the REITs and how they discuss, like, you know, occupancy percentages and EBITDA and all of that. Great, cool. But also, like, what's happening to the people that we're caring for? This isn't just a transactional business. It's a business of compassion and empathy. So I say that there's no limit because if we're doing it, it means that we found a way to be able to account for those needs, which, again, I go back to this kind of this ability for me to realize I don't have to control everything. You know, it was like a little personal growth over there where now that I know how well we've structured our foundation to be able to scale and support others to be able to literally own and operate in those areas, I know that if we're responsible with segmenting those regions, that we can make it work with the right deals in the right areas with the right people and the right leaders. And again, you ask the same question on the cash front of it. We have a good track record. You know, I mean, our financials have proven that. We've been able to option most of our majority of our real estate now. When we came initially as leases, we've been able to finance direct acquisitions now with direct purchases without having to go through a lease process because the banks now trust us. So thankfully, we've built up a good reputation, you know, thank God, that allows us now to be able to apply that at a larger scale. So As long as the numbers are there, as long as we believe in what we can do with it and we have the right things in place, sky's the limit.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a very, very interesting area of discussion for me, particularly in investments, and we can go on and on about it, but wanted to turn to some other lines of questioning, and one of which is like new service lines. Have you added any new service lines, and what is your company's strategy in doing so?
So primarily dialysis is always, in-house dialysis has always been a little bit of a, what's the word I'm looking for? A baby for me as well. Like just, it's just because it's one of those areas that why not try to be as much of a one-stop shop for your hospitals as you can be? And why not be able to provide as much in-house for our residents as we can? Right. I think as a business, my mind has always been as much as I can do in-house to in-house, whether that's my accounts receivable, whether that's our negotiations, whether that's our housekeeping and dietary departments. You know, the more you're doing in-house, the more you can effectuate quality without compromise. When you're contracting things as a general rule or going out for anything, there's two incentive structures going on. There's what they want and there's what you want. And what benefits them, what benefits you. So bringing in-house dialysis as a service line means that we can focus on making sure that we're not just, sending people out to the hospital and then potentially getting readmitted somewhere or going to a dialysis unit where maybe they're doing something that is more beneficial for their numbers versus, you know, our numbers as it relates to return to hospital improvements and what we're getting dinged for and held accountable to. So that we've added to multiple sites. Most of our facilities at this point, 11 out of 16 or 17, 11 out of 18 of them now it's 18. Mm-hmm. Are we at 18? Yeah. 11 out of 18 now, like our 12 out of 18 now, have in-house dialysis that we've built dens in there to be able to serve better those communities. So that was always a big belief of mine. Vents was an area that I had always been scared of. My grandfather was on a vent before he passed away, and it was like it was again an emotional issue that I had where I didn't feel good because I didn't like the way that I remembered him in that state, and it didn't feel good to be able to do that. I like feeling good about our business, you know. I like feeling good about the care that we're providing and what we're doing. It's not just a head in a bed. You need people in the beds, right? You got to be making money, but like there's the person and how we're treating them. So I didn't really feel comfortable with that. And I started realizing a little bit when I kind of like got out of that headspace a little bit. And it was actually just, 3 years since he's passed. Why not do it, but do it well? Why not do it better? Like instead of avoiding the whole thing because of a bad experience I had, why don't I look at that as an opportunity to like, I hate to say it, make it sexy, but again, make it sexy, you know, make beautiful units. We took over a building a few months ago and right away, even though like the building came in, it was losing like, I can't remember, it was like $300,000 a month or something in that building, bananas. But we came right away. What do? We did a complete rehab on the vent unit, because they had a vent unit there. And I mean, it looks beautiful, you know, and very often that community and that service line, if you will, kind of gets treated as like, okay, they should just be happy that they have a place, you know? So just be quiet and go in the room. And it's not usually pretty rooms that they're in because like they, you know, they're not cognizant or whatever. What about the families coming in? You know, again, what about when I came in and had to see my grandfather, you know, sitting there like and looking like he was neglected? It was the yuckiest feeling ever, but it's like, well, what are your options? You know, where else are you going to go? So kind of making a, called the Taj Mahal of event units was something that we're now moving towards with our Thrive line, which is that was one of those sub sister companies that we started. We started with one of the three facilities that were required to have that, and the other two will be including the vent units there as well. I mean, our return to hospital in that building is better than in some other sub acute buildings. I think it's at about 14% last month for a building that's got high acuity running 18, 19 vents in there. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. The team there is amazing. So Thrive Burbank, well done. But I want to continue being able to grow that instead of looking at it as a taboo area, make it the best. So we are going to be adding that in some units.
You're saying, are you envisioning that you will be adding these vent units in a majority to all of your facilities in the future?
To the Thrive, specifically to the Thrive line. I think, again, if you try to do something like that where it's such a high-risk care area, it's not a plug-and-play, like, let me just drop a... Putting a dialysis unit in is a little bit less of a lift clinically for your facility. I mean, you typically partner with another organization that really owns a big chunk of it and helps a big with most of the day to day on that front. With the vent unit, it's your team that has to really see the whole thing through. So I think it's a mistake when people build too many vent units. Besides for the saturation it creates in the market, and thereby potentially reducing the quality and kind of experiencing what, you know, I was unfortunate to experience with my grandfather. I also think you don't get to focus on the quality as much, and I want to keep it tight on the vent units. Again, there's a need for it, but I want to do it better and differently, and that's not by doing it everywhere. So we're really focusing just within that sister company on the respiratory end and the vents. You know, if you try to be good at everything everywhere, you end up finding yourself being mediocre at everything. I'd rather be good at one or two things and not try to be one all be all. And then compromise in areas that you shouldn't be able to compromise on.
Okay, great. Turning to your model of care, you may have touched upon some of this already, but do tell us about any interesting initiatives on cost savings and quality improvement.
Well, I'll say one cost savings that I don't know if it's a model of care cost savings, but the reduction of overtime. I know that for many people, they view overtime expense as kind of a baked-in expense where, you know, it just is. You know, we're just happy to not have agency in our buildings, you know, or, you know, some people still do have staff, you know, agency in their buildings. To me, if you have a high overtime percentage, that just means you're burning out your team. You know, it means that they're working double shifts constantly and there's no human being, if we're being honest with ourselves, that can work a 16-hour shift and say that at the end of a 16-hour shift that you are doing the same quality as you were able to provide at the end of an 8-hour shift. Mm-hmm. Sorry, it's a comp. Now, again, sometimes those compromises are made because out of need and the alternative is much worse, which would be potentially not having someone there. But again, why not have both? Why not have someone there, but not have them running into overtime? And part of that challenge is culture and willing to invest in the rates and paying people more. But thankfully, under how we've handled things with both making sure that we remain competitive with our nursing rates, we treat people, I believe, mostly well. You know, we're not perfect, but we try to do a lot of fun stuff. We try to do a lot of morale programming and leave open to lines of communication. We do monthly town halls in our buildings where art's not there just for like in services, it's to welcome feedback. And it's worked. Our overtime percentage as an organization is at approximately 2.5% overall. And I actually had someone that recently, one of the partners that we brought on to start the facilities, was like, he's like shocked because I came from where his car was. Like, he's used to like seeing 20%, 23, you know, 25% for nurses, for CNAs. And I'm like, well, that means you're either doing a bad job training them, you know, training your team, you know, supporting them, or you're not paying them well enough, or you just don't care enough to like dig down and understand the why. So that in particular, I mean, you're talking about so much money that you're saving and so much better care that you're able to provide because of doing a better job taking care of the people that are taking care of our people. So that's been a huge element of our model. Beyond that, again, there's a value to scale. There's no question. I mean, having more facilities and more buying power absolutely helps you. I think one thing that we do in general is avoid the compromises that people make sometimes when they want to do like joint ventures, you know, and they own a piece of like four different companies and they're like, okay, sure. So we're getting charged up a little bit more here, but we own a piece of it, so it's fine, right? Or, we're not fighting them on the rate so much because like either way, like I own a piece of it, so whatever. That bothers me. That bothers me. That means that you're basically saying I'm okay with compromising as long as it lines my pockets a little bit somewhere along the line. So our approach has always been whether we have ownership in something or not, it doesn't matter. We're treating everything equal and on merit and merit alone, not because of who's related to who. Maybe you get an opportunity because you're related to somebody. Maybe you get an opportunity because there's some, you know, partner that might have ownership in something and you get the door open. But if decisions are being made objectively and based off of what's, how do we get the most bang for our buck, get what we need without compromising on that, I found that there's a lot of savings that are to be had there. And the last big cost-cutting measure is on our liability insurance, which a lot of facilities we've taken over. We've seen people that either have captive insurances that were that ballooned out of control with their costs. And again, people might not care as much because like, oh, well, it's our money anyways in the Cayman Islands, you know, and there's like, oh, you're gaming the system. Great, but you're screwing your building potentially. That's A. And then B is if we just do a better job of taking care of people and we mitigate our risk better and we handle our risk better and we go to court and we fight, we're not settling. If we know what we did was good and we actually believe in our care, then you see your litigation going down, you know? And that has helped significantly on keeping our general liability rates down. I mean, we still have commercial insurance. We don't even have a captive because our rates are good and competitive and overall do a pretty good job of taking care of people, you know? So, thank God.
Interesting. Turning to value-based care and reimbursement, how is Alia positioning itself to leverage value-based care opportunities and what role do you do quality metrics such as rehospitalization rates play in shaping your reimbursement and growth strategy?
So it's interesting. It's always been the case that if we do a good job of taking care of people, if you provide good quality, you will make more money. It's a general within, if you're responsible, right? I mean, there are people that just, you know, spend too much money and aren't watching anything. And they're just like, well, it's all in the name of care. Yeah, but then now you're losing $500,000 a month and you can't afford to pay anybody and now you're shutting down, you know, or making cuts somewhere else that ends up hurting someone. So the idea of value-based care and a lot of the incentive structures, whether with the rehospitalization component that, again, with the 2%, whether with QRP, specifically in Illinois and many other states where quality measures factor into your Medicaid rate. Now seeing more in the ACO model where that admits per thousand kicks in for your shared savings and that you can potentially get back if you own the ACO or partner with ACOs. I think these are all natural progressions of just do a good job taking care of people and you'll make more money. So none of this is rocket science. I think it's maybe giving a little bit more of a carrot to people to motivate them to do so. But, you know, I don't really look at any of it and I was like, oh, maybe I should start caring about return to hospital. You know, this is, I didn't think about, you know, one of the single most important metric that encapsulates everything from your nursing care to your customer service to your your experience and everything, you know, goes back to return to hospital, always has. So yeah, do a great job of return to hospital. Do a great job of keeping people in your facility. You want them there because they're going to help you. It's going to help you, one, make more money, because you're going to make more money on a person that's in your facility than out in the facility, you know, out in the hospital, and all these other initiatives. So none of this has really came out where I'm like, oh, let me start working on those things. I think it's more about how much risk do you want to own as a part of that. So in the ACO world, that was, to me, that was the most exciting. I'm not a huge iSNP fan. Anyone that knows me or that's tried to sell me on iSNPs knows that I think it's a little bit of an overblown trend that maybe works in particular regions and particular facilities, maybe for some particular organizations, but it's certainly not a one-size-fit-all model, even though they're trying to scale and trying to grow and therefore they have to sell as if like it's great for everybody. So no offense to all those iSNP people, but I think the ACO model doesn't really touch as much. Doesn't really change the workflow of care like an iSNP does. It doesn't limit care really like an iSNP does. It just allows you to take a chance on, do you really believe in your care? So I love it. I would like to find a way to be able to, and I'm you know, as we continue building up more beds and building more volume, I would like to be able to have my own ACO, you know, or with some strategic partners, particularly where we're taking more of that risk on there and the upside within that. Because, yeah, why not? Why not take a bet on our care and know that what we have is good enough that we should benefit a little bit from that. So that I'm excited about. I haven't fully figured it out, not gonna lie. But that is our next step there, is to develop our own ACO. I think contracting with another party, once again, is similar to contracting anything, which is you're automatically compromising because your incentives are inherently not always going to be aligned. They're aligned in some areas, but not in all.
Got it. I mean, I think this is another question I had, like kind of an offshoot of what you've been just saying with ACOs or similar to it, perhaps. But you have a collaboration with Advocate Health, right? And I'm just wondering if you could dig a little bit deeper, you know, there and explain like what sorts of, you know, benefits have you gotten from that collaboration, the PanSNF program in particular?
Yeah. I'll say this. I can't say this for all PANs or post-acute networks or for provider networks or whatever they want to call themselves for compliance purposes at any given point. Advocate, and I will give I might be pissing off people by saying these things right now, so I want to preface it by saying that Advocate in particular, and I would say as well, I'm gonna rope Northwestern hospital system as well into this, and maybe it's my affinity for purple that leads me down to be a bigger fan of those two. But they're a very matured post-acute structure that they provide that gives an open line of communication and collaboration where they have a nurse practitioner or a physician that's actually rounding and collaborating within the facility that sometimes is annoying, you know, because sometimes you get the annoying one who's a little pokey or whatever it is, but they're actually trying to help you do a better job of taking care of people. Not just the residents that are associated with them. In general, they're looking at you as a true partner. So it's not so much about like, sure, their structure is good, right? They've got good meetings. They've got good metrics that they hold you accountable, that we're held accountable to, that we continue to communicate with and we look at. But everyone wants good metrics. There is no preferred provider network or hospital who's going to say, oh, we don't really care about our MSSP population getting good quality and you know, we don't want that. And we don't have a standard that we expect. Everyone has a standard we expect. Everyone wants return to hospital below 12% always, no matter what. Everyone wants there to be, you know, roses and sunshines across the land. The question is, are you willing to really help? Because where I've seen success has been with both hospital systems and physicians really being a part and really truly showing that they're not just delegating responsibility, but having a shared sense of responsibility with us, which I would say, again, Advocate is an incredible partner on that front, where, I mean, there's direct lines of communication. It's not a finger-pointing contest. It's, okay, how do we make this better? So we've seen a lot of that. Now, again, comes with struggles because there is a component of the business that's also just sales, right? So if you have a better salesperson or a sexier brand or whatever it is, or referral patterns that you're trying to change, sometimes it's hard to adjust those because even if you're doing all the right things and even if you're openly communicating or being transparent, you know, someone else might look prettier without actually doing better. It might be getting better than, you know, maybe a better flow than you. But I mean, we were one of our facilities was number one in that region, the Southside region, with admissions, you know, even though maybe we weren't the prettiest kid on the block. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that has what to do with really as a hospital system, one that really is committed to quality collaboration and really believes what they're saying, not just saying it to make it look good on a quote on a website.
Do you have any metrics for reduced hospitalizations, maybe with that program or otherwise for ALEA?
I wouldn't say I don't have one off like the cuff right now, if I'm being like totally like real. I mean, I've looked at it recently. If I'm recalling correctly, specifically those, I gave you like that 17% for like overall, all buildings, everything, all payer mix. But specifically with Advocate, we've typically trended below or at the 10 to 12% for return to hospital. Our length of stay has always been within the not mistaken, sort of in the 10 to 12 day range for length of stay, which again, we hit those metrics. We collaborate and I'd rather do a great job at that. And I know when that model changed and length of stay model changed, a lot of people got scared. And I just always viewed it and said this for years. And actually, I shouldn't even take credit for this. This was my uncle, Daniel Weiss over at Bria, that always said, you'd rather do a good job with what you have and keep to the rules of the road and maintain those lower lengths to stay than not have that patient at all in your bed because you're so stubborn in sticking on the ways of the past. So, our belief is let's work together. Let's have less of more instead of having more of less. So that has worked well and continues to work well and something that we believe in with all of our hospital partners.
Yeah, no, that number that you shared of 10 days or so, the length of stay is, even below what the average length of stay is for what Advocate Health shared with us. And they said it was 16.6 days. So your numbers are even better. And I think when you compare it to the national SNF average, again, according to Advocate Health's figures, it's 27.5 days. So your figures are in pretty good shape, I think. So thank you for sharing those metrics. Wanted to turn.
Do you want to see? I'm pulling it up right now because I want to validate it because I don't like just making up numbers. And then if I'm wrong later, I'll be upset at myself. Mm-hmm. So let me just see this right now. Yeah, 11.1. Our biggest pan sites are 11.1. We do have some outliers that have closer to that 17, 18 range you said. But for our high volume sites, we average, 11.1. Yeah. Well done.
That's pretty good. So wanted to turn with that, with some, discussion on workforce. And you mentioned already over time and how you've been able to improve the quality of your workforce by reducing that, if I understood it correctly, what you were saying earlier. Just wanted to generally to ask you how staffing pressures seem like they've eased, right? And is that one of the reasons why you've been able to get more people to come in and work at your facilities? And you mentioned offering better wages too.
So I don't know, right? I don't know about every other organization, what they are and aren't doing. If people are still using agency in my mind, I find that shocking. I think that there's something fundamentally missing then if you're having that happen into today. But I mean, there's a workforce. Yeah, there absolutely is a workforce. And I mean, we came in post-COVID, fallout. I mean, starting in the beginning of 23. So I was already kind of building back a little bit. But the reality is, if you pay good wages and you're a good place to work, then people are going to want to work by you. I mean, market's going to guide it that way. So these numbers that I'm sharing with you, I mean, below 3% or overtime, that's with staffing a budget at our buildings. There absolutely is a workforce there if they want to work for you. Mm-hmm. If they don't want to work for you, then amazingly, there's no staff to be found. So, again, be attractive, care about people and do the best you can and own your mistakes and be aggressive. Don't settle. Don't make excuses for yourself. Don't try to justify a poor outcome, mm-hmm. Find the means to provide a good one, whatever is necessary. So, again, I think that kind of just attitude helps instead of trying to make ourselves feel better about our failures. Let's just make successes.
I wanted to quickly toss in a question on workforce metrics for you and see if you have any numbers on turnover, retention, agency use at all off the top of your
head. I don't actually. It's funny you asked the turnover question. I just looked at one, I just didn't know if it was real or not. It said we were at our retention rate. We were retaining 93% or 94%, I think, annually. But I don't, what that means, I don't know. Cause I looked at four different platforms. Some of them are within 120 days, someone leaving, some of them within a year, and what they're using as their numerator, So I hate to just use a number and not be able to validate it. Because I can just make data sound good or I can give you real. So the number I have is that we're retaining on average 94% annually with our team, which means, I guess, 6% of our workforce is turning over, which Sounds really good to me. I mean, I'd like 100% retention across the board. But I know that's not realistic because you also have to hold people accountable, and sometimes people have to go, and sometimes people leave. Unfortunately, it does happen. Keeps us honest. So that's that. As far as agency use, I mean, we don't. There's no agency in our buildings. There's thank God. Not a need. We had two buildings that for, I believe it was 1 or 2 weeks, a few months back, maybe 6 months ago or so, that we did use agency there. And it was intentional, but it was during one of those periods in which, like, okay, we knew we had some poor performing providers within the building that we needed to be able to move on. And, you know, it was kind of like, well, hate the threat of like, well, then we're gonna have to use agency. Like, fine, we'll use agency, but for 2 weeks, you know, and then we're gonna make sure that during that time we get it back because then it's gone, which worked very well, you know, and we made the hard decision, but it was very, very much, if you're using agency, you're using it as a sniper, not as a shotgun. Mm-hmm. So that was the bare minimum usage that we did have. But thankfully, you know.
Thankfully, it's zero right now. So that was
where
you said that.
Quite some time. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I just got to own that. You know, I'm not pretend like everything's always hunky-dory. Like, there's always that nice underbelly that everyone likes to pretend doesn't exist.
Right. For Medicare Advantage burdens, how is Aaliyah dealing with those and negotiations and all that?
Ugh. I'm just going to say they're monsters, man. It's just, you know, like we talked about, like, general outsourcing, right, and incentives not being aligned. Mm-hmm. Medicare is basically contracting Medicare management to insurance companies that their incentive is, how can we provide as little care and as little money and maximize our profits? Mm-hmm. That's it. And they're not responsible for the outcome of care. You know, we are. Like, if we got length of stay issues, people go back home and they end up back in the hospital, whose readmission rate looks bad? Mm-hmm. Ours, the hospitals, you know, if they're stuck in the hospital and the hospital for extra late days because they're not getting authorization from a managed care organization, guess whose length of stay looks bad? The hospitals, you know, like it's crazy. So like they're basically and we switched to PDPM, right, which is a model that makes a lot of sense. It's based off the care you're providing, the acuity that you're providing. Mm-hmm. Managed care doesn't care. Here's your levels. Here's what you're getting. Figure it out. Mm-hmm. Oh, you're telling me that, like, based off of clinically backed data, you know, that which is what PDPM is, right? It's all clinically backed. It's all, you know, all peer reviewed. That data is telling me that you need this amount of money. You need $750 a day to take care of this patient. Here's $350. Here's $400. Go figure it out. Good luck. It's insane. So, I mean, it shouldn't be legal. It's nuts that it exists. And I hope that. I hope they get karma and their just desserts and there is some way to change that. I wish I could say I'm doing anything to help, but I maybe one day, but I'm kind of out of my depth on trying to help fix that one.
Yeah. Turning to surveys real quickly, how have those been going for Aaliyah, and have you been reporting any concerns over the processes?
Thank God. Much better. You know, like I said earlier, when we first started and you asked me, like, well, you know, biggest challenges and hurdles, like I said, was the regulatory environment and then the surveys. It was hard. It was also because they didn't know us, right? So you see some young, loud, bright organization coming in there and they're like, oh, we'll put these youngins, you know, we'll let them know. So there's a little bit of like almost like a hazing period that we went through until they realized like we're not full of it. You know, we put our money where our mouth is. We even hired an ex-state surveyor that worked for us full time that was really helping enhance our survey processes and really showing our commitment to improvement and getting better. So both in conjunction with improving our quality, we've also improved our reputation, I believe, with the department. And we've seen, you know, again, more open communication, more collaboration. And thankfully, you know, what I was talking about earlier, I'm seeing that such a positive trend overall in how we work with them. So again, some of the sins of the past are still there, you know, when it comes to like the star rating and health inspection. But by and large, we have continued to move in a positive direction. And seeing that starting to reflect in some of our surveys and some of our star ratings that have gone to like 4 stars and 5 stars overall have been a direct result of that. Because, I mean, that's where it all starts and it's getting better. Thank God.
Great. So we've come to the end of our time, and I'd like to end this podcast with this question that we ask everyone, all of our guests. This podcast is called Rethink. What's something that you think leaders in the nursing home SNF sector need to rethink? Could be anything, like, you know, operational practices, a common mindset, business practice.
Where are you getting your information from? I think that especially as organizations grow, very often the high level leadership in the C-suite gets lost at sea. As it's a little pun work over there, but it's a true, real thing that I've found happen to myself and struggle with as well. That the information you're getting is kind of a little bit from like a feedback loop. You know, it's a bunch of people that are validating you or telling you what you want to hear or what's going to make you feel better, whether that's with blaming a building for something that's a failure, really, as an organization and as something that reflects poorly maybe on you, where your data is coming from and what your data actually means. Like when we were talking about the retention rate, I be honest with yourself, you know, be honest about where the information is coming from. And more importantly than anything else, and I'll say it till I'm blue in the face, nothing will ever beat showing up. And it's an area that I find myself struggling with as we've grown. And again, part of why I've shifted to this more of that regional model and bringing partners in to be able to run it, because I know you can only be in so many places at once. But when you're actually there and you're talking to people, you get real information. We had a struggle recently about some new initiative that we introduced and some issues with adoption. And I'm hearing something from everyone in corporate. I went to the buildings and talked to them directly. And I was like, oh, this is why. This is the difference between here and here. Because it didn't make sense to me. Like, you guys were okay with accepting the answer because you want to give an answer. Just because it's an answer that makes sense, it doesn't mean it's the right answer. So again, back to how we rethink is, where is your information coming from and what are you doing to make sure that it's real? And the answer to that, for the most part, is show up. Expect what you expect. Don't just believe what you want to believe because it, you know, helps close out the tab that you got open and your task manager.
This was fantastic. Thank you so much, Efren, for joining us today on the Rethink podcast.
Thanks for having me.
That does it for this episode of Rethink. I'd like to remind listeners that our Rethink conference is taking place September 28th to 30th in Philadelphia. Visit snnrethinkconference.com to learn more. I hope to see you in Philly. Until next time, thanks for listening.